Hello, and welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast. In late January, a team of investigators from the CDC reported findings from the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, indicating a significantly low risk of myocarditis following vaccination with either available messenger RNA vaccine for COVID-19 in persons aged 24 years and younger. Cases of the inflammatory event occurred 1,626 times after an mRNA vaccine dose in U.S. patients from December 2020 to August 2021. Though the prevalence of myocarditis was deemed significantly low, it is something that Dr. Matthew E. Oster of the CDC and Emory University School of Medicine says is worth taking note of. Dr. Oster spoke with managing editor Kevin Kunzman of how the CDC is monitoring these events, as well as the risks to cardiac health that patients who aren't vaccinated against COVID-19 face.
Okay, so Dr. Oster, once again, thank you so much for joining us. This is obviously a very, unfortunately, interesting and very pressing, findings being gathered still from our understanding of any and all COVID-19 vaccine risks. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion leading up to the widespread authorization and implementation rollout of COVID vaccines and the age stratification prioritization that we've been approaching this entire thing, the entire benefit risk portfolio that's being uncovered still. This is just the newest addition to our interpretation of it. Of course, your team's research into a particular myocarditis risk being faced. I wanted to start and ask if you could provide what you took away as, I guess, the most pressing and maybe even surprising findings.
Yeah, so, anytime, when vaccines are rolled out, we have an obligation just to understand, not only benefits, but also risks, to put everything into a good, benefit risk assessment. And so with that, CDC has theirs, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, run jointly with the FDA. And so, we've been monitoring for a number of different adverse events, including, myocarditis. And so as we started seeing reports and hearing about cases of myocarditis, we really wanted to get a grasp on how severe is this? How common is it? Who's being affected? And what is their clinical picture looking like? So that's kind of going a little bit beyond what we typically do. And, so what we found is that, yes, this does appear to be a real thing and a real side effect, that it primarily affects males, females a little bit, but primarily males, and primarily males kind of in that 12 to 29 range. And that was consistent, with what we see with kind of classic myocarditis, if you will, kind of the viral myocarditis, that sort of pattern. What was surprising, though, we went a step further to really get that grasp of, all right, well, how much are people affected? And so we did, really intense follow-ups and phone calls and reaching out to the providers who cared for these patients. And what we found is that this is not the same as kind of our traditional classic myocarditis, if you will, right? Much less need for critical care, no ECMO or transplants. No deaths in the cases that we were able to fully investigate. So it seems to be a much milder course with a good, quick resolution of symptoms with minimal treatment. And so that was very surprising and reassuring. Yet, as you'll see in the paper, a lot of these kids had MRI findings, which, make you say, huh, we should follow that. We should watch that just to make sure things get better. And so right now there is a process ongoing where we are following as many of these patients as we can. We're calling them and we're calling their providers as well. Their cardiologists are following up with to find out, all right, how are you doing 3 months from this? Is this a long-term problem?
Thank you for that, Dr. Oster. And it did stand out to me in reading over the research and covering it the other day. The note on avoiding physical activity, obviously, if we're talking about young men, adolescents, we might be seeing high school athletes, collegiate athletes. I know there's some anecdotal concern with COVID infection, which we could talk about a little bit later, and risk of myocarditis in some younger athletes. I remember some data specifically out of Wexner that was observing that in Ohio State athletes. But speaking specifically to that sort of guidance, is there any sort of recommendation or advisory that you put out to clinicians in terms of early monitoring, early symptom detection, as you're saying that there is a distinction from that general viral myocarditis?
Yeah, so for the post-vaccine myocarditis, you know, the classic story is, as I said, a male, you know, young male, he's about 12 to 29 years of age, and having severe chest pain. And the severe chest pain we see is actually, you know, many of these stories when we're reading them and reaching out, it was just coming out of the blue at rest. You know, it wasn't necessarily brought on by exercise or anything like that. And was in usually about 2 to 4 days after vaccine. So, you know, if a patient has pretty severe chest pain in the first week, I would say, after having an mRNA vaccine, the patient deserves, you know, a thorough evaluation, likely in the emergency room, so you can get a troponin back quickly. But, you know, if the troponin is normal and an EKG is normal, then, you know, probably not myocarditis. You know, all these cases pretty much had abnormal troponins, and most of them had abnormal EKGs. So if those are normal, you know, you can still have kind of run-in-the-mill chest pain, which is very common, but not myocarditis.
Right. Well, that's great to know. And turning back again to that point earlier about actual risk also associated with viral infection with COVID-19, can we talk a little bit about the disparities? Both, obviously, we're talking about presentation here, but prevalence and severity alone, what do we observe with COVID-19 infection contrasted against the vaccination? And is it in different patients? So,
I know it's scary when we're talking about kids and having myocarditis from having a vaccine, yeah. But it's still not nearly as common as having, you know, heart involvement from COVID. You know, when you have COVID, a number of things can happen, you know, related to the heart. So first, clearly there's the acute infection really affecting your heart, getting pretty severely infected. I'm a clinician much of the time, and we have some pretty severe cases. You know, even one kid right now who's quite ill, who's unvaccinated, got COVID, and was very sick in our cardiac intensive care unit. And that was unavoidable. That was an avoidable outcome. Two, even if you don't have a, you know, really severe heart infection during your, you know, acute COVID you know, episode, you know, as you mentioned, you know, there've been studies in athletes showing that, yeah, there can be some heart inflammation there as well. As many as 2%, if you go looking for it all, about 0.3%, you know, even if you just go by clinical symptoms, that's still a lot higher than the myocarditis we're seeing in vaccination. And then third, though, is MISC is a very real thing. It's a multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. You know, this affects about 1 in every 3,000 kids who get a COVID infection. About 1 out of 3,000 will get MISC, and about 80% of those will have some sort of cardiac involvement. And many of those are really severe cardiac involvement as well. So there's a lot that can affect the heart as a result of COVID. And because of that, you know, we think the benefits of getting vaccinated and avoiding those bad outcomes still outweighs, you know, the risk of myocarditis. The risk of myocarditis, I don't, you know, it's real, it is there. It's something we need to monitor and watch, but it is still much lower than the risk of getting cardiac effects from COVID.
And something that I guess I personally feel when covering this and having these conversations is my initial worry when I come across things like these, aside from the actual observation, is the opportunity for it serving as a fodder for fear for people who may not fully understand, who are more wary of the vaccine versus the virus, as we're coming to understand there's a huge portion of our population, unfortunately, that is still very vaccine hesitant, maybe not anti-vax, but looking for reasons to be wary and concerned about providing vaccines. And speaking specifically to that pediatric population, where again, our understanding of the benefit risk profile is just slightly different. It's slightly different from our older or immunocompromised or, you know, otherwise demographically compromised patient populations that we need to prioritize for protection against COVID. Dr. Osa, I'm curious to ask if there's any sort of other follow-up that's going to warrant, you know, better informed guidance of any potential risk factor associated with children? Does this really move the needle, I guess, for our understanding and prioritization of children vaccination against COVID?
Well, you know, with any sort of program, it's good to be, you know, truthful and transparent and say what we know. And that's why we did this study, saying this is what we're seeing. You know, you mentioned children, and we're continuing to look in the younger age group. You know, this has been reported in some of the national meetings, but I'm happy to reiterate that the rates of myocarditis in younger children seems much lower than even what we saw in these older kids. So that's very reassuring. In those younger kids, MIC is even more common. So still, for sure, the benefits of the vaccine do outweigh the risks. We just want to make sure that people know, you know, what the risks are so you can manage them. But the risks of not getting vaccinated, I think, are much greater.
And I really do think, Dr. Oster, if I can mention, I think it's really fascinating when we consider, I guess, the dynamic of older adolescents to the young adult population. Obviously, very early into everything, the very first authorization being granted ages 16 and older, it is sort of fascinating when you consider the role of adolescents at that age, both in working in, you know, the workforce and really needing them to be available to continue their work at a time when we're having some structural issues and shutdowns, lockdowns only. The word keeps escaping me, but our essential employees, they were part of that workforce and really being targeted for an opportunity for protection. Obviously, not that all the data is not always going to be lining up perfectly what that sort of prioritization looks like. So it is interesting to see that distinct contrast of where you're looking at later adolescents versus younger adults for COVID protection. I'm curious to ask you, is this something that's very COVID and pandemic specific in terms of our prioritization? Is this something that's been, I guess, informed by prior vaccine immunization strategies? Is this something that's going to be sort of influenced by COVID going forward? The sort of age grouping that we see?
You know, those are all excellent questions. I don't have good answers for you. I was not part of the determining, how things were rolled out. And a lot of that was state-based more than, necessarily nationally based. But I think we can learn a lot from how things have gone and what we've learned. And I think certainly, lessons learned from COVID will be applied to any future, pandemics or other public health emergencies we may have.
We'd like to thank Dr. Oster for being part of the program, and thank you for listening. If you want more COVID-19 news, make sure to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. We'll be back this Thursday with another episode of Doc Talk. Until then, stay safe and stay healthy.